What up? Another episode of The Connected Show. I am Ruben Torres. Thank you guys for tuning in. This episode is I think it's, you know, one of my top favorites that I've done. I'm going to be hanging out with Conan. Conan is a world famous luchador from back in the day, man. And me and him have been friends for a long time. Got a lot of interesting stuff. He's got a lot to say about the industry, the state of the industry, and where he's at right now, his relationship with Rey Mysterio, all kinds of stuff. We talk WCW, we talk ECW, we talk WWE and Lucha Underground. So make sure you guys check this out. This episode is brought to you by Milton Motion. Make sure you reach out to my boy Tim Hernandez, doing big things, creating websites, creating podcasts, producing, doing all kinds of good stuff. And make sure you check out his photography. Dude's a beast. And any other stuff that comes up, man, you guys need, reach out to us. We're going to try to be helping out some other cats here in San Diego, doing some more podcast stuff. So you guys need some help, reach out. Let's do this. Let's get connected with Conan. Get connected.
Yo, if you're C-O-N-E-C-T-A-D-O, you already know about the show, so let's go. It's your music and lifestyle, fashion profile, the entertainment source for everything you want to know about. North to the south, the east to the west side, stay connected with Ruben Torres worldwide, so let's go. Across the globe, well respected, beasting on the industry. Connected.
Conan, what up?
Yo, what's up, Ruben? Thank you very much for inviting me to be on your show. You know, we've been friends for a very long time, and it's always good seeing you at wrestling matches, or we've even bumped into each other on a train on Amtrak once. We were both going to L.A., yeah. And, you know, we always seem to be bumping to each other. And the one thing I've always, you know, respected you is you're much like me, very pro-Latino, very pro-Raza.
Yeah, thank you, man. That means a lot coming from you, brother. That means a lot. Man, if I know, you know, we got a long history, man. So if we can kind of get into, you know, just kind of your entry into Lucha Libre. I know you've probably said the story a million times, but just for the listeners that are new on my show that don't know the history, if you can kind of jump in on how you got involved in wrestling.
Yeah, well, I was stationed in San Diego because I grew up in Miami, and I was stationed in San Diego. I came here when I was like 17, and so basically, what happened is that I was on the Navy boxing team, and I got hurt. When I got hurt, they put me on a ship. So I was stationed here, you know, for all of you that are in San Diego, stationed on 32nd Street, which, for those of you that don't know, that's a humongous naval station here in San Diego. And so I was, you know, at a park in National City. That's where I lived when I first came here. And, you know, I was shadow boxing and training, getting ready to get back into the boxing ring. By that time, I had gotten into bodybuilding. So I had exploded from a middleweight, because I was 1983. I was the California middleweight champion. I had exploded from a middleweight to a full-fledged heavyweight. And so this guy, this is probably a story that's way different than anybody else's, but this guy saw me in the park, and he, you know, he invited me to go to Tijuana, which is on the border of San Diego, to watch Lucha Libre. Now, remember, unlike you, Ruben, that you grew up on Lucha Libre, and many Mexicans, I didn't grow up with Lucha Libre. So I grew up with what I watched in Florida, which was at that time called NWA wrestling and some WWE wrestling. So, you know, the only guy I'd ever really seen, there were a couple guys I'd seen in the mask, but the one that always struck out the most to me because of his elegance and just the different masks he had in his physique was Mil Máscaras. So he was like, yo, why don't you come to Mexico and check out Lucha Libre? And I was like, wrestling, man, you know, F that. I don't even watch that. And he was like, yeah, well, you like boxing, right? And I go, yeah. He goes, you know, Salvador Sanchez and, you know, Julio Cesar Chavez. And, you know, those were all great boxers. And there's some great wrestlers in Mexico. So I was like, you know what, I'll go check it out. And I went there and I was just completely mesmerized by the mask, the capes, the high flying, the different style, the 2 out of 3 falls, the just the sheer rowdiness of the crowd. It was like I'd never been in that type of environment, you know, and I was like, wow, this is incredible. And, you know, the guy was like, yeah, you know, I'm a world champion. And he went into his car and he showed me like this, you know, title belt. I'd never seen a title belt. And at that time, this guy was limping. And I was like, well, if this guy's a world champion with a limp, imagine what I could do. And he was like, well, yeah, I'm limping because they beat me up in the dressing room. And, you know, but I'm getting back into shape and I'm going to get him back and blah, blah, blah. So back then, getting into wrestling was real hard. It ain't like today where it's very easy to get into wrestling. It was real hard. And so he brought me back into the dressing room, and it was on a Sunday. For those of you that know about wrestling, the promoter slash wrestler Kiss used to do on Sundays. Benjamin Mora used to do on Fridays. Oh, yeah. So anyways, we went in there, and, you know, this guy that I had met, his name was John Roberts. He told Kiss, yeah, you know, I was real, you know, I was bigger than anybody in the locker room at that time physically. And he goes, yeah, this guy's wrestled before in Florida. And I was like, no, I haven't. And he was like, just go along with it. Just go along with it. And I was like, all right. And then he goes, and so Kiss turns around and he goes, well, who have you wrestled? And I started to name all these wrestlers from Florida that I could remember from TV. And he was like, all right, well, next week I'm going to book you in the first match. I was like, what? He goes, yeah. And so I was telling this guy, bro, what am I going to do when I go in there? And he goes, same thing you do in boxing, just knock the guy out. And I go, you want me to walk into the ring and just knock the guy out? He goes, yeah. He goes, nobody's ever done it. And I go, well, fuck, why didn't anybody think about that before? You know, I mean, and so, because I thought wrestling was real, bro. Because even when I went to the dressing room, I had asked one of the wrestlers, I go, well, how much is this predetermined? And because I couldn't really tell what was fake and what wasn't. I mean, it didn't look very legit because, you know, guys were getting punched in the face and they didn't have any bruises. But there was other shit that I was like, holy fuck, that did happen. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I wasn't able to distinguish like what was real and what was like, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, the guy was like, well, what do you mean? It's what's real and what isn't real? And, you know, this grizzly veteran, and he was like, you know, he was in front of the whole locker room. He was like, what, you don't think it's real? You know, you and me can go at it right now. And the other wrestlers were like, you don't think this is real? You know, and don't come in here and disrespect us. All right, well, I'm just asking, you know. So this guy was like, yeah, just go in there, you know, knock the guy out, and that's it. And I go, what if they throw me to the ropes? And I fought through the ropes. You know, everybody's going to laugh at me. He goes, don't worry. You're not even going to be thrown to the ropes. The guy's going to be knocked out. And he kind of had me convinced, you know. And so, you know, I had like an outfit made, and the outfit wasn't made on time. So this guy was like, yeah, you can wear my gear, you know. And his gear didn't fit me, and I really looked ridiculous. I go, wow, can you imagine if I go through the ropes in this suit? I'll be the laughing stock of Mexico. So when we got there, I saw my name. They had actually billed me as the Incredible Hulk. And I was like, oh my God, you know, this. I go, I'm going to have to actually go in here and knock somebody out. You know, that's not really a big deal for me, but something doesn't seem right, you know? And I go, and so I told him again, I go, bro, if I get thrown through the rope, well, he goes, I said, look, just teach me how to hit the ropes. And I promise you, I'll go there and I'll do, you know, whatever you need. So I get to the, so that Monday I go to train, and Rey Mysterio Sr. is there, Rey Mysterio Jr.'s uncle. And he was putting on oil, and he goes, are you the one that's wrestled in Florida? And I go, well, really, I've never wrestled. He goes, why did you lie? And I go, well, because my manager, he goes, wait a minute, you've never wrestled and you have a manager? And I go, well, yeah. Doesn't everybody have a manager? And he was like, no, everybody does not have a manager, especially somebody who's never had a match. I go, who's your manager? And I go, the world champion, John Roberts. And I pointed to him, and he goes, that guy's not a wrestler, he's a fan. I was like, oh my God, some fan like tricked me into thinking he was a world champion and brought me to Tijuana. And that's, and then Rey Mysterio was like, you know what, I'm going to train you. And like, I was there with like, because I'm Cuban Puerto Rican, and I was there with another Cuban guy from Miami who was in the service, and another guy from New York who was in the service. He was actually in the Marines. And we went in there, and man, you wouldn't believe what they put us through. I mean, they literally just beat us up all training session. You know, I fractured my hip, I fractured my wrist, I had a concussion, I couldn't eat because I was so dizzy. All I wanted to do was, you know, throw up. And they were like, you know what, F this, we're not coming back. But I just refused to. I loved it a lot, you know, I really liked it, and I just refused to give up. So I just kept going and going until Rey Mysterio was like, you know what, I'm going to train you properly. You know, obviously you're not going to leave. So that's kind of like how they tested you back then.
Nice. And that was the, yeah, the beginning of it. Did he end up giving you the Conan gimmick?
No, he actually, at that time, man, I loved wrestling so much, I didn't care. You could have called me the pencil sharpener, and I would have dressed up as one and gone out there and wrestled. I just wanted to wrestle, man, and just hear the crowd cheer, because I was always a natural ham anyways, you know, like when people would come to my house for parties and shit, like on, you know, New Year's or Christmas or whatever the occasion may be, you know. Yeah. I was always going out there and I was dancing like Michael Jackson, or I was doing, you know, I was just very hyperactive, and I was a ham. Even when I was boxing, I used to dress up like Hector Camacho, you know, with these cowboy suits with frills, and I was just a character, you know, just like naturally. And so, you know, I think there was an entertainment aspect of it that I really enjoyed, plus the fact that I've never seen wrestling like this in my life. You know, American wrestling seems so simple and boring compared to this fast-paced, colorful style. And basically, what was I saying?
About the gimmick, the Conan
gimmick?
Somebody
just talked to me, broke my train of... Huh? Oh, the Conan gimmick. So anyways, yeah, so I'm sorry, somebody just talked to me. So Rey Mysterio basically gave me this name of El Centurion. And I was like, what the hell is that? And he goes, yeah, man, that's like, you know, back in the Roman days, that was kind of the guy that gave the order to all the soldiers to, you know, attack. So it's actually a really cool name. At that time, like I said, I'd gotten into bodybuilding and I had long hair. And so the announcer looked at me, and he just goes, no, 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 no. And he goes, and in this corner, Conan el Bárbaro, which means Conan the Barbarian. Yeah. And I was like, what? And people were just like chanting my name, you know. Nice. And like from the very first day that I wrestled, you know, I was drawing people, and I had what they call in Mexico, el Ángel, the angel, which, you know, guys like Santo, Blue Demon, Rey Mysterio Jr., you know, Místico. You know, it's just like people just like you, man. Whether you're good or a bad wrestler, people just like you. Yeah. And I was very, very fortunate, because I rose like very few people in this business.
And you were one of the first to do so much in the industry. I know you got a list of a bunch of stuff. And I know I'd asked you this last time I seen you. You were one of the first wrestlers to be on the first episode of Monday Night Raw, right? Like back in 92 or something like that?
Yeah, right, as Max Moon.
Yeah.
And, so basically what happened is I had gone to WWE as Max Moon, and they were like, at that time in Mexico, it's kind of blowing up, and I was blowing up so much that Pedro Damián, who's the guy that, you know, did the concept for RV7, he had a soap opera. It was actually for kids, and in it was Gael Garcia, who's probably the most popular Mexican actor right now, and Ludwika Paleta, who was very famous in Mexico, but Gael's like, you know, real famous in the U.S. Diego Luna was in it, you know, but they were little kids.
Yeah.
And this very famous Mexican personality at Resortes. So anyways, I was in this soap opera, and it was for kids, and kids love wrestling too. So it just, you know, really made me a mainstream star at that time, you know. So I was like, you know what, because the outfit that I was wearing, that Max Moon outfit, actually, you never saw the whole thing, but there's pictures on the internet of me with Vince McMahon actually going over, like, what he wanted for the outfit. And the outfit was actually going to shoot fire, and it was going to shoot smoke, and it was going to shoot confetti. Wow. And it was really elaborate.
Yeah.
But I had to bring this outfit all the way from Mexico City, and I would fly to LA, because this guy in LA was putting it together. And if I had to wrestle like in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, for example, I'd have to put all the boxes on the plane, take a flight all the way to Boston, drive all the way to Cape Cod. Wow. It was actually a big pain in the ass. Yeah. And you know, I was in the ring, I was drawing really big crowds. And then I had this, I had this soap opera. And of course, you know, I was doing all the TV shows and everything. So I really blew up really quick. And so I was like, you know what? Forget it, WWE. So I didn't show up for some TV tapings and they fired me.
Yeah. And even back in Mexico, you were breaking records for attendance, right?
Yeah. I still hold the all time record, which is like 50,000 plus Plaza de Toros in La Ciudad de Mexico, which was my retirement match against this guy called Cien Caras, and which was actually Triple Mania number one. They're on like Triple Mania 23 or something now.
Yeah, wow. And so you've pretty much traveled all over the world, because you did Mexico, you did Japan for a little bit, you did pretty much went all over, right?
Right.
And
right, right. I've gone. Yeah.
And then you've ended up in pretty much all the major TV promotions here, TNA, you do ECW, all that stuff, right?
Right, right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. What would you say has been the big difference between all of those, the big promotions that have been on TV?
You know, each one of them has their own style, their own personality, their own front office, you know, and their own character. You know, ECW was run by Paul Heyman, you know, who's a genius. You know, he was out there just doing stuff way before his time, you know, and a lot of the stuff that he did, you know, really revolutionized wrestling at that time, which was like 97, because at that time he was using like music, you know, Alice in Chains, he was Nirvana, you know, Dre and Ice Cube, you know, he was just using a lot of mainstream music. He was really good at what he would do is he wouldn't show the whole match. He'd just show clips of the best parts of the match. You know, so if there's a long, boring match, you'd never see it, you know.
Yeah.
He was just really ahead of his time. And he was a real good friend, you know. And so he had like, you know, what he was really great at was hiding the limitations of a wrestler and accentuating his strengths. And he had contacted me once and he goes, hey man, I heard about, you know, Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr. He's another wrestler that was incredible. Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr, Love Machine, might've been the best tag team I've ever seen in Mexico. If you're a wrestling fan, go to YouTube and check them out. They were called the Gringos Locos.
Yeah, I remember that.
For a while I joined them and all three of us were Los Gringos Locos, but they started it and you know, it was their baby. You know, so he was like, you know, I said, man, they're the best tag team in the world. But at that time, they were in Japan. He goes, what about Rey Mysterio and Psicosis? And I go, well, those are two guys I discovered in Mexico, and they're my boys. And with all due respect, I've seen your show. Your show's the bomb, but these guys are going to go in there, and nobody's going to be able to follow them. And he goes, really? And I go, yes, really. And he goes, all right, well, send them to me. And, you know, Rey Mysterio, you know, must have been 5'4", maybe weighing 150 pounds, maybe, you know, Psicosis was maybe 5'8", maybe weighing 150. He was so skinny, he was embarrassed to take off his shirt, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I told him, you're going to go in front of a wild, because, you know, for those of you that don't know, Philadelphia fans, they're just wild, you know? Whether it's football, hockey, basketball, whatever, they're wild fans. So if you did something wrong, they let you know immediately. They are not polite in the slightest, and they'll let you know.
Nice.
And so, you know, they went out there and they killed it. And I was in Mexico that week because I had to go to a TV taping. And he called me and he goes, Conan, he goes, can I have these guys back next week again? And I want you to come down too. And I go, yeah, sure, Polly. You know, boom, and we came down. And from there, WCW saw us, and then they called me. And the minute I got there, I said, hey, you need to bring in Psicosis. You need to bring in Ray. You need to bring in this guy. You need to bring in that guy. And that's how Lucha Libre actually kind of started, you know, in the United States. And it's a style that has, you know, influenced, you know, all the young high flyers of today. And, you know, Lucha Underground and NXT and any guy that's doing any aerial moves, you know, from Kalisto to, you know, whoever it is, they were all influenced by Ray and Psicosis and, you know, Juventud and what those guys were doing back in WCW 97.
Yeah. And I've always said that. I've always said that Conan was, in my eyes at least, that Conan has always been the one responsible for the crossover of Lucha Libre. And, you know, it's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that that people don't know. Tell us a little more about the stuff that you do behind the scenes that people don't see, because I know you're flying all over the place and you're doing stuff, you know, whether it's just on the creative side or writing or training or coaching. You got a lot of stuff going on. Is there anything you can tell us about backstage?
Well, it was just, you know, when AAA started in maybe 92, the owner, Antonio Pena, had asked me if I wanted to help write the shows and help produce the shows. And I was like, yeah, you know. And so, you know, I was writing all the shows, you know, when I was like, I don't know, I must have been 27 years old or something. I was writing, you know, episodic TV and I was producing and I was really getting behind the scenes. I spent a lot of time, you know, in editing bays, learning how that craft was done. And so I really learned behind the scenes how to better package myself as a star. And so like for the last 10 years, you know, I've been writing and producing and developing talent, recruiting talent, cultivating talent, you know, for AAA in Mexico and in TNA, which was some of my best work. I had this group called LAX. It was called Latin American Exchange. And it was kind of an extension of it was kind of like me being mad at the wrestling business because, you know, since I've been in the wrestling business, I've been in almost 30 years. And whether I was in TNA or ECW, WWE or whatever it's been, I've never met a Latino writer. I've never met a Latino producer. I've never met a Latino in a position of power. You know, and, you know, I was one of the very few guys that they would actually let me get away with my own verbiage because they like to script stuff for people. But what I was talking about, there's no way, you know, an Anglo could really write that, you know, so they would actually let me do my own stuff. So like when we did Latin American Exchange, which was basically a group of led by me, I was like the militant Latino. And the only way you could be in our group is if you were Latino, you know. And we had like a group of guys called the Latino Nation. And, you know, I would have little sayings like, you know, you can stop a revolution. You can stop a revolutionary, but you can't stop a revolution. And, you know, to live and die in LAX and all these militant slogans. Mm. And I was talking about something that's so prevalent right now, you know, about, you know, racism against Latinos. Yeah. And, you know, if you go to YouTube and you put in TNA LAX, you'll see a lot of the stuff that I was doing back then. Yeah. But it was, you know, it was just me reinventing myself, you know.
Yeah.
Same thing like when I went to Lucha Underground, I reinvented myself there too. And so, you know, I'm behind the scenes now, yeah. You know, and I got a couple projects coming up that I can't talk about at the moment. But when I can, I would love to come back to your show and announce them so that people can support it.
Yeah, heck yeah. And do you know, yeah. Or do you feel that still to this very day, because you've been in it for a long time, do you still feel to this very day that there's a lot of racism against Latinos in the politics of wrestling?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely. And the thing is, it's more subtle now. You know, when I was younger, it was obvious, you know, and, you know, I remember my mom being a Cuban immigrant, you know, they're making fun of her accent, making fun of her. You know, being in the military, I was in the military 6.5 years, you know, a lot of racism there. And I grew up in a place where there really wasn't racism, you know, like where I grew up, there wasn't. And so for me to actually experience it was pretty eye-opening. And then when you get into wrestling, when I first got in, Jesus Christ, there were hardly no Latinos in the business, you know. Now you see more than ever, but, you know, it's subtle. You know, I'll give you an example. We're probably approximately 17% of the United States population, right?
Yeah.
More or less. On TV, we have 4% representation, You know, we're underrepresented everywhere, you know, behind the scenes, in front of the screen, you know, and so it's ridiculous. That's why I always try to help, you know, I'll help anybody, but especially if it's a Latino, I always try to help him, you know, because even now when you look on the screen, do you watch TV much or no?
Yeah.
Are there a lot of Latino actors and actresses that you look up to?
No, I can't.
Are there a lot out there? You know, and that's one of the problems. You know, that's one of the problems. We're underrepresented. Yeah. You know, there's guys that when you see them, like Danny Trejo, you know, that's cool, you know, and all that. But there ain't a whole bunch. You know, when I was growing up, there was like hardly none. I remember, like, I had to watch Lucy. You know, Desi Arnaz was Cuban. Yeah. They had this one show called Chico and the Man.
Chico and the Man,
which is actually, which was hilarious. It was Freddie Prinze playing a Mexican, but it was hilarious, you know? Yeah. And I was like, wow, a Latino, and he's using some Spanish words. Oh, my God, you know? And, you know, back then, even in music, you never heard nothing. You didn't hear any Spanish word. You didn't really have any Latin crossover artists. Now it's a big thing. You know, Pitbull's crossed over and Shakira's crossed over. And, you know, in music, I think we've done a good job of that.
Well, you know, and even in WWE now, how you see stuff, even there's hardly any Latinos involved in WWE now. And I know they got the Lucha Dragon stuff, but I mean, there's hardly anything going on. Do you,
because you it's hard to write, you know, I'll give you an example. If I was running a promotion in LA, and LA is, you know, cosmopolitan city with a lot of ethnicities. And let's say some guy was a Japanese star and he was humongous and he was drawing Japanese fans. I wouldn't try to write for him. I can write in general, and whatever I write, I'm going to get an emotion out of you because writing is universal, but ethnicity specific. So you have to get a Japanese guy that could write, you know, his, if he's not a good talker, that could write stuff, you know, for promo so he can get people to come and see him, you know. And, I would write so he could cater to, you know, Asian sensitivities and things that they're interested in. I don't know what they're interested in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in general, we're all interested. You know, we all know what hate is and greed and love and, you know, the seven sins. And that's one of the blueprints that most writers use to write. They use one of those things, but, you know, I don't know what's specific to their culture. So I would hire a Japanese writer or two to help me write for the Japanese demographic. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Why that hasn't happened in wrestling is beyond me.
And do you think someone as seasoned as like Alberto Del Rio, do you think he needs someone to be?
Oh, yeah. He told me, you know, Alberto told me you saw him, I think, once when we were together in the dressing room in Tijuana, you know, and he was saying it. He goes, you know, I told Vince a million times I need a Latino writer because they were writing him really some really bad stuff. And he told them over and over, I need a Latino writer. I need a Latino writer. He even told me, will you come to WWE, you know, and write? And I said, sure. You know, if they call me and the money's right, why not? But they haven't. And so the bottom line is, you know, when Alberto came to AAA, we did great business together. You know, we put the title on him. He's a world champion. Mm-hmm. He could speak. You know, he had a great look, you know. And we did we had real good chemistry together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he wanted to replicate that in WWE, and there's still a chance that it may happen. But, you know, I have not gotten that call. But, yeah, you know, when you're putting – he's going out there. They haven't really booked him well. A lot of the stuff that he's done, especially since he came back, because he came back and he beat John Cena as a surprise.
Yeah.
Ever since then, they put him, you know, and I don't want to bore too many people with wrestling talk that may not even know what I'm talking about, so I'll go through this real quick. The first thing they did, have you been watching wrestling lately or no?
Yeah, I've been keeping up.
Okay. The first thing they did when they brought him back is, I don't know if you saw this, they put him in with Zeb Coulter.
Yeah.
The motherfucker looks like Yosemite Sam in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, really? Where is the chemistry there? You got some guy, some old time Western, even looks like a racist, Yeah. You know, I'm not saying that he is, yeah. but, you know, from Texas or wherever the hell he's from, Tennessee, you know, with this young, virile, you know, Alberto Del Rio, and basically what they were trying to do, if you remember, they had a Mexican flag stitched up with an American flag.
Yeah,
right, right. Right, and they were trying to, what they were trying to do is they were trying to espouse Mexican-American unity, because for those of you that don't know, Alberto Del Rio, who's Mil Máscaras' nephew, over a racist remark, slapped somebody in WWE, an employee, and he got fired over it, you know?
Yeah.
And the employee didn't get fired over it, and that, you know, was a real big deal. So they were trying to show the people, oh, look, there's no racism here. You know, Mexico, America are together. And the Mexican embassy actually called them and said, hey, dude, you know, the flag is sacrilegious. Don't be sewing it with the American flag. You know, we don't play that.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, they are. They're very serious about the Mexican flag in that regard, you know. And so they had to stop that angle. Then they put him in with another angle called the League of Nations, which is also brutal. So they haven't booked him right. And this guy, bro, he just standing, wherever he's standing, he's just oozing charisma. He's a star.
Yeah, yeah, he's a star. Definitely, he's a complete package on the whole thing. And he just kind of left abruptly, too. What are your thoughts on the way that, if you can talk about it, What's your thoughts on the way that that Ray left?
Well, you know, with Ray, it was a question of they were trying to, you know, they felt that he was very injury prone because he was getting hurt a lot. But of course, Ray was injury prone. He's A, your lightest guy. B, he's the guy that takes the most risk, you know. And C, he's not 20 years old anymore. You can't run the guy ragged. I mean, you know, he has a shelf life like anything else, or like a car that after a while, you know, the odometer, I mean, you know, he has a lot of miles on him. You know, Rey Mysterio, when I met him, he must have been like, maybe 13 or something. I don't know, 14, something like that. And I remember I used to go to wrestle in Hollywood bars, and I would put a mask on him, and he was real small. And they'd be like, hey, you know, I need to see ID. And I used to tell him, I go, he's a midget. He's very sensitive, too, so don't say nothing, you know. And so I'd bring him in, and he'd kill it, bro. He'd kill it. And the same guy that was asking me what his age was taking pictures with him, because you knew Rey Mysterio, even though he was small and even though he didn't fit the blueprint of what a wrestler looked like, I always thought in the back of my mind, this guy's so small. And he's so sympathetic that anytime you put him against anybody big, and the bigger the better, everybody's going to go for him because visually he's the underdog.
Yeah.
Then on top of that, he's one of the most, and you're a big wrestling fan, so you know what I'm about to say is true. He is without a doubt one of the most creative wrestlers I've ever seen. He invented so much stuff, you know. Psychosis invented so much stuff. Another guy that was like that was Sabu. You know, for ECW, since we were talking about them, but these guys were guys that were originating new stuff that had never been seen or done before, you know? So not only did you like him because he was small and you felt bad for him, the guy was amazing in the ring. So I knew back then this guy one day, you know, was going to make it big. Never did I think this big because there were so many obstacles for a guy his size in the business back then. But guys like him and Eddie Guerrero slowly and surely broke them.
Oh, yeah. And you were pretty tight with Eddie Guerrero back in the day, too.
Yeah, very tight. Eddie's from El Paso, Texas, which is on the border of Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua. So I would go wrestle in Ciudad Juarez where his dad, Gory Guerrero, which to many is considered the greatest Mexican wrestler of all time. It's funny because when you would go into Eddie's house, there was a picture of his dad. This is awesome. He's got about, I don't know, maybe five kids. You know, there's Mondo, Chavo, Hector, Eddie, Cookie, there's like about six or something. So there's a picture of his dad. When you walked into his house, he was doing a bridge, okay? His back's not touching the floor. A bridge, I think he was holding like a little barbell in his hands, and then he had all his children standing up on top of him. That's like just an incredible picture of, you know, how old school his dad was, you know?
Yeah,
and
awesome.
You know, he used to wrestle with Santo, and he started riots, and he was incredible. And so, you know, me and Eddie really, we really connected because he was from Texas, you know, but he spoke English and Spanish. I was from Miami. I was bilingual, you know, I was maybe four or five, maybe 5 years older than him. So, you know, we kind of had the same likes and stuff. And I kind of, you know, he was showing me how to wrestle and I was getting him into bodybuilding because he was real, real skinny. And believe it or not, real, real, real shy. And so, and I was very outgoing, very like over the top. And so, you know, we really, you know, had a huge, you know, then after that, he came to work for us in AAA. We were together in Arena Mexico. We were together in WCW, you know. So, yeah, we became very close. Eddie, without a doubt, I would say, and not because he was my friend, he's maybe the greatest wrestler I've ever been in the ring with.
Wow. Yeah, and you've been in the ring with some greats. Yeah. So that, yeah, that's a big deal. I know, you know, I had the honor and pleasure to work with them too when you hooked us up with WCW and we ran around doing the LWO stuff back in the day. And he was definitely one of my favorite people that ever came in contact with, as far as like working with celebs and just the whole thing, you know. So, and I know.
Well, he, you know. Let me tell you an Eddie story real quick. Eddie really evolved. You know, he had his demons and his pill problems and his alcohol problems, which a lot of them are very well documented. But Eddie was very religious. And I remember people would come up to him, wrestlers would tell him that they were having problems. And Eddie would stop what he was doing, bring his Bible, read a scripture to them. Fans would call him. Would call him on his phone because he'd give out his number. He'd meet a fan that was going through something really tough. He goes, if you ever need some help, just call me. And I go, you're actually giving fans your phone number? He goes, yeah. And I saw him, people calling him and him talking to them on the phone.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, man, that's special. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, I remember even just the first day that I met him, he not only gave me his number, gave me his home address. And he was just, he stayed in, the first day that I met him, he stayed in the same hotel room with me. He was like, nah, man, you know, I got to be up in a few hours anyway. I'm just going to go ahead and hang out here. And dude, he was just like the opposite of what you've seen on TV, man. He was definitely just the sweetest dude ever, man. And
very, very humble, just like Rey Mysterio. Very humble.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one thing, that I always notice too is the mic skills, being a wrestler, you know, yeah, you got to be great in the ring, but I think the other, you know, I don't know, 25, 30, 40, 50% of it has to do with mic skills. Tell me about that, cutting a promo and being good on the mic.
Yeah. I think my whole thing is that I had two frames of mind. Like I said, I spent a lot of time in editing bays, and I would look at the wrestling matches and the promos. You know, promos are like interviews for people that don't know. And I would see what type of interviews, you know, resonated the most with fans. And so, I tried the two things I always tried to do was, one, I never tried to do a wrestling promo. Oh, I'm going to retire you, or I'm going to, you know, I'll get you and all this other stuff. You know, I always wanted to make you think, you know, especially when I was in LAX, I did a lot of stuff to make people. And the other thing that I tried to do is, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you, Ruben, but it has to me. Is like, I don't know if you've ever been watching like a Barker channel, and all of a sudden there's a preview for a boxing match or an MMA match that maybe you weren't that interested in, but the shit they were talking, can I cuss here or not really?
It's all good. It's all good.
The stuff.
Yeah,
we've been. Yeah, the stuff they, I don't want to disrespect, you know. the stuff that they were saying, you know, back and forth, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
A lot of times, oh my God, I got to see this. You know, and I'd end up buying it, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I'm on the mic, I always thought to myself, what can I do to put what we call asses in seats, make a fan want to come see this match? So, you know, I always try to pattern my my interviews, my promos, if you will, with that in mind, you know, not a wrestling promo, you know, not your typical wrestling promo, what every wrestler says. And number two, what could I say to make you come see me, you know?
Yeah, because no matter what city you were in, you could be in, yeah, in wherever, somewhere in Wichita or whatever. And I remember every time you used to come out and you yelled, Viva la Raza, you would have even like the craziest white boys even chanting, you know, Viva la Raza.
Right.
And
yeah, well, that was very funny because usually when I came out, I'd go, Órale, and then Órale, Arriba la Raza. And that did a lot of things. Number one, to me, was interesting because I could go anywhere from, you know, Louisiana to Tennessee to Montana, you know, which highly populated white areas. And all these white boys were repeating what I was saying. They had no idea what I was saying. They just thought I was cool or my gimmick was cool. You know what I'm saying? And they were repeating it. But it was a shout out to La Raza, to the people that made me, you know, because if it wasn't for Mexico, I wouldn't be where I am today. So it was my way of like, you know, nobody else is shouting you out, you know? And so, man, I've had everything from gangbangers to people from prison to car washers to, you know, just come up to me in the street, man. Thanks for representing. Thanks for representing. And that was one of the things, if you remember, when we first did our first video, which was
Psycho,
which was actually a Mad One track.
Yeah.
Which he let me get in on. I forgot, what was it called? Psycho.
Yeah, Psycho.
That's a great, great track. And wow, he wrote some great lines. And I insisted we do it in Chicano Park, if you remember.
Yeah.
And that was my way of, again, you know, just showing the Mexican culture in San Diego and kind of giving a piece of the Mexican art and the whole Mexican vibe. That we had Lolos there, you know, we had car clubs, we had La Raza was in the house, you know?
Yeah.
And it was my way of kind of like, you know, and you guys did such a great job.
Yeah, thanks, man. Those were the days, man. You know, what's funny is I had this band called Islander. They're from South Carolina. They came down to San Diego last week, and you know, I was hanging out with the singer and the bass player. We took them to eat right there in Barrio Logan, they wanted to see Chicano Park. You know, I took them to Chicano Park, and as we're walking in that direction, the singer, Mikey Carvajal, he was telling me how much of a WCW fan he was. He's like, yeah, I wasn't really a big WWE fan. I was more of a you know, WCW fan. And he's like, man, all I can remember is that Conan did a music video somewhere here. And I was like, yeah, this is it right here, you know? And it was just funny that it just came back to that. And, you know, and he's, you know, he's a white guy from, you know, Midwest out there. And for him to remember that,
right,
you know what I'm saying? Like, you know,
yeah, that's dope.
Yeah.
And the funny thing to me was because I always had like a secondary, you know, reason for doing it there, because when I was reading up on my history, you know, they wanted to put like a police station there, if you remember.
Yeah.
And the whole Toda la Raza was like, nah, man, you know, this is going to be a park, you know,
and
they protested and they protested and they got it done, man. Much respect to Barry Logan. And, you know, but, you know, then we did another one. If you remember, we did one in a Fullerton, Tokerstown.
Yeah.
And that one was still, again, an homage to La Raza. I got dressed up in Zoot Suit, which, you know, I didn't grow up around that. I didn't even know what it was when I was a kid. But once I started to read up on my Mexican history and Chicano history and being around, you know, living in Cali, you know, I was like, wow, what a dope scene that was, you know, Zoot Suit. Imagine wearing that actually back in the 50s in the streets. No wonder, you know, Los Gabachos were pissed off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you know, what's crazy thinking back on that too, was, you know, we had everybody from Baby Bash to Kid Frost and Rey Mysterio.
Kid Frost.
And
back then, you know, like I grew up, you know, Miami, again, hate to be redundant, But like, you know, we didn't have, you know, Bloods and Crips and Cholos and all that, or low riders. We didn't have none of that. So when I came here, you know, and like, I remember, you know, I know I'm being very specific to San Diego right now. So if you're not in San Diego, excuse me. But, you know, these guys like from Southeast San Diego, like Black Mikey, you know, yeah. B-Stone, you know.
Mitchie Slick.
And I remember going to Mitchie Slick. What happened to Black Mikey?
He's still around. He's still doing his thing. I think he just released a project not too long ago.
Wow, man. He was incredible. Yeah. I mean, he was just incredible. Yeah. I remember, I'd never seen this in my life. B-Stone, have you seen him in a while or no?
No, I haven't seen him in a minute.
Bro, B-Stone was the first guy I ever saw, because I remember going to the recording studio and he rapped like a whole song. And I remember the producer was like, yeah, we need to do that again. He goes, well, I didn't write nothing down. He goes, well, you need to start writing stuff down.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't believe this guy had done that off the top of his head.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, what skills, you know. And so, you know, and that's how I bumped into Tomas Lopez, you know, really through you.
Mm-hmm.
Mad One, who's, you know, he's an incredible writer. He's like a Mexican poet to me, you know, yeah. Urban Mexican poet.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah, he was back in those times, he was on a record label called Skyline, and I just finished I produced a music video for him that we shot out in Yuma, and we had just barely finished it, and then I had hooked up with Ray, and he was telling me, oh man, I gotta hook you up with Conan, and I had showed you that like a clip of that video. I don't even think it was done yet, and you were like, yeah, that dude is dope. Yeah, and we showed you the track,
yeah.
And then even like for the second track, I think, you know, we'd gotten you in the studio up in LA in Paramount Studios, I believe it was. And,
yep.
And
yep.
You went in there and recorded that. Talk about like getting into the music, aspect of it, because a lot of people may not know, but you were actually rapping for a bit.
Yeah. What I had, well, you know, we were very influenced by New York, because every winter, all the New York cats would come down to Miami to chill because it was really cold up there. So we were really influenced, like, really by New York. And, you know, they had their own estilo, bro. And then when I came to Cali, you know, Los Negros had their own estilo. Los Chicanos had their own estilo. And so, you know, I had to learn the slang. You know, I had to learn everything because it was just very different. The Miami beat was very different. You know, Miami's was very like bass, you know, Luke Skywalker, you know, Two Live Crew, you know, Cali was on a whole different tip. And so Mad One helped me a lot. Mad One helped me a lot with my rapping because I wasn't as polished as I thought I was.
Yeah. And then Kid Frost wanted to jump on some stuff as well, right?
Yeah, he did. He did, man. Kid Frost was incredible. What's he up to?
Last I heard, brother, I think just last week he made an announcement that I think he was dealing with cancer. I know he was diabetic.
What?
Yeah, man. I know he was dealing with he was struggling with diabetes, and then you know he's been in and out of the hospital, and then I just heard that I'm not sure what kind of cancer he got, but he announced that. That he was going to be battling cancer.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, Godspeed, man. I hope he can beat that. He was like one of the first of all, I loved his voice. It was incredible, right?
Yeah.
Just a tremendous voice. You knew he was Chicano when you heard him sing. And that song, La Raza, to me was like, wow. Especially there was one line that I never forgot. He would say something like, if you don't understand this, this isn't for you anyways. This is for La Raza.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, boy.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, I just felt that song so much, you know, that if you were a Chicano, especially a Chicano in Cali, you had to feel that song. Oh, you know, yeah. Which one I'm talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Come on. Oh yeah. He
yeah.
was, he's
so,
the,
he
was like the godfather of it all. He's like, the,
yeah, yeah. So, you know, yeah, he was. And, you know, when I heard him and then I heard, you know, that group Tierra, who's awesome, you know, and all that music, you know, and just the different, you know, Chicano music, whether it was Santana or Tierra or Kid Frost, you know, and then of course, I loved Cypress Hill, you know. It's just it's incredible to see the evolution of Chicano music and Latin music in general.
Yeah, man. And so now, you know, you went from doing, you know, because you did some music back even before you were doing the stuff on WCW, right?
Right. I was doing stuff in Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I had a rap album there and I had done some stuff on like a whole bunch of variety shows. But that was in Spanish.
Yeah.
U.S., of course, I had to do it in English. Or even, I remember, mostly Spanglish I like to do it in. But, you know, the music industry, it isn't what it used to be, bro. And, yeah. You know, you really got to go out there and hustle now. And but what has always saddened me is in San Diego, so much talent. Because I remember even back when Mad One, there was a Chicano, ¿cómo se llamaba? Little Joker, was that his name?
Oh, yeah, Little Joker.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't know, man. Yeah, there's a lot of these guys. I haven't
Maniaco?
No, I haven't seen or heard from any of these guys. I know, I think Night Owl's still doing some stuff, and I haven't heard anything from Shadow or any of these guys, but I'm sure they're still doing some stuff.
There's so much talent here, bro. So much talent. Mitchy Slick, bro. Come on.
Yeah.
Clack, clack. Come on.
Yeah.
And, you know, and nobody's really blown up. San Diego artists, you know, they never really helped each other, you know, and that's a shame, bro.
Yeah, and for those listening that don't know, I also directed Mitchy Slick's first music video called Triggeration Station, and if you check back,
that was a great song.
Yeah, man, and
great video too.
There's an episode of one of my shows that I got Mitchy Slick, and I interviewed Mitchy Slick, so you guys can catch that as well. But let's take a quick break for 60 seconds real quick, and we'll jump back on real quick.